AIDS everywhere, guaranteed riches for institutions and individuals who signed on to Dr. Fauci's gold rush. The pharmaceutical multinationals like GlaxoSmithKline, minting enormous profits marketing antivirals to kill HIV, had little incentive to challenge Dr. Fauci's orthodoxy. Africa's AIDS bonanza. With grants from Tony Fauci, intrepid researchers quickly found that the contagion had somehow reached Africa and infected up to 25 million Africans, with no one having taken notice. Researchers, extrapolating from small cohorts with positive PCR results, used murky statistical models to report HIV had infected nearly half the adult population in some nations and forecast widespread depopulation of the African continent. None of the shrilly predicted depopulation has ever occurred, and most HIV-infected Africans showed no sign of illness. In those who were sick, the infirmities looked very much like the illnesses that doctors had previously diagnosed as malaria, pneumonia, malnutrition, leprosy, bilharzia, anemia, tuberculosis, dysentery, or infection with a grim inventory of pathogens and parasites familiar to doctors in Africa. Because HIV antibody tests are too costly for widespread use in Africa, the World Health Organization has since 1985 used the Bangui definition to diagnose AIDS based on clinical symptoms. WHO's enthusiasm for this loose, all-encompassing definition may reflect the early revelation that the AIDS plague loosened purse strings like no other crisis on Africa's beleaguered landscapes. The statistical picture of AIDS in Africa, consequently, is a sketchy projection based on very rough computer-generated estimates from the World Health Organization, built on a highly questionable data pool, dubious assumptions, and grotesque exaggeration. Uncertainty prevails, even in those extremely rare cases when doctors actually performed HIV tests on Africans. Many diseases that are endemic to Africa, such as malaria, TB, flu, and simple fevers, trigger false positives. Duisberg and many other critics accused Dr. Fauci and an opportunistic pharmaceutical industry of taking this long inventory of ancient afflictions and recasting them as AIDS. It's undeniable that African AIDS is an entirely different disease from Western AIDS. Whereas AIDS in Western countries continued to be a disease of drug addicts and homosexuals, with women reporting only 19% of U.S. and European AIDS cases. In Africa, 59% of AIDS cases are in women, with 85% of cases occurring in heterosexuals, and the remaining 15% in children. No one has ever explained how a disease largely confined to male homosexuals in the West is a female heterosexual disease in Africa. AIDS in Africa looks nothing like AIDS in North America or Europe, observed Duisberg to me. Africans were rarely tested with expensive PCR tests, so every unexplained death became AIDS. The clinical symptoms of African AIDS are high fever, a persistent cough, loose stools for 30 days, and a 10% loss of body weight over a 2-month period. By that definition, a large percentage of Western tourists have AIDS while in Africa. The simple cure is to get on a plane back to New York, where no doctor would dream of bestowing an AIDS diagnosis based on that symptomology alone. After 1993, WHO added tuberculosis to the definition. Duisberg told me, it became a garbage-pail definition applied to anyone sick with an uncertain diagnosis. Due to compelling financial drivers in Africa, AIDS is nearly always a presumptive diagnosis applied without any positive reaction to HIV tests science journalist Celia Farber told me. Big pharma, researchers, clinics, international health agencies beginning with WHO, and local governments conspire to keep this stunningly broad and generic clinical definition of AIDS in Africa, she explains. From the beginning, it was a signal for funding. They are all in on the joke because they are all helping themselves by skimming the unprecedented international funding streams that flow to African AIDS relief. AIDS is huge business, possibly the biggest in Africa, says James Shikwati in a 2005 interview with Der Spiegel. Shikwati is founder of the Inter-Region Economic Network, a society for economic promotion in Nairobi, Kenya. Nothing else gets people to fork out money like shocking AIDS figures. AIDS is a political disease here. We should be very skeptical. Former epidemiological director of WHO, Professor James Chin, in his 2006 book, The AIDS Pandemic: The Collision of Epidemiology and Political Correctness, admits unambiguously that the AIDS case figures for developing countries were massively manipulated in order to maintain the flow of billions of dollars. Dr. Rebecca Coleshaw, Ph.D., a former HIV researcher and professor of mathematical biology and population dynamics at the University of Texas at Tyler, admits that the paradox of how a disease could cause both vastly different epidemiologies and symptomatic progressions in the first and third world was one of the irreconcilable problems that sowed her initial disillusionment with the HIV/AIDS orthodoxy. The African epidemic looks suspiciously nothing like the American and European epidemic, and closer inspection reveals it likely that this African epidemic is pure fabrication. The questions about widely divergent symptomology of this mysterious disease only amplify when we consider that WHO maintains 12 different descriptions of AIDS depending on national boundaries. In 2003, AIDS activist Christine Maggiore told documentarians, "In 1993, in this country, we adopted a definition that caused the number of AIDS cases to double overnight. And part of that reason was for the first time we began counting people as AIDS victims who were not ill and who did not have any symptoms. They had a low T-cell count, and that's all. And T-cells are something that can fluctuate up to 100% in a given day. So based on a low T-cell count that year, the number of AIDS cases doubled overnight. And with that definition, there have been 182,000 Americans who are not ill, diagnosed with AIDS, who would not have AIDS if they moved to Canada. Because in Canada, they don't recognize that T-cell definition as a criteria for having an AIDS diagnosis. Many U.S. AIDS sufferers can become cured by crossing the border into Canada. No other disease is so subject to this sort of nationalism. Correlation is not causation. In May 1984, a month after his momentous press conference, Robert Gallo finally published his paper claiming to have discovered the HIV virus in Science. He also explained in detail his rationale for linking HIV to the AIDS disease by reporting that he had found evidence of the virus in several afflicted gay men. Gallo reported a frequent detection and isolation of HIV from patients with AIDS and at risk for AIDS. Scientists were shocked to learn for the first time that Gallo had found faint traces of HIV in only 26 of the 72 AIDS patients whose blood he examined. That weak conclusion was Gallo's only basis for claiming that HIV might cause AIDS. It's axiomatic that correlation does not prove causation. There were many other viruses, including herpes simplex, cytomegaloviruses, and a range of predatory herpes viruses found with a far higher frequency in AIDS patients upon which Gallo could have just as easily blamed AIDS. A year earlier, Dr. Luc Montagnier also had only suggested, in his May 1983 paper in Science, that his claimed virus may be involved in several pathological syndromes, including AIDS. Montagnier, a brilliant scientist known for his integrity, had found evidence of HIV in the lymph nodes of 72% of the 44 AIDS patients he tested. Montagnier always remained tentative about claiming the weak correlation as proof. As early as 1992, Montagnier told Nature that HIV is a necessary but not, without the cofactor, a sufficient cause of AIDS. As we shall see, Montagnier's later statements indicate that his doubts about HIV's role in the etiology of AIDS continued to grow thereafter. Based upon Gallo and Montagnier's slender scientific needs, these seminal papers introduced the idea that a single, discrete virus was causing the AIDS pandemic. Dr. Fauci has since routinely claimed that HIV was proven definitively to be the cause of AIDS by Bob Gallo here when he was at NIH. But critics argue that evidence in Gallo's article is far too anemic to support Dr. Fauci's characterization. Neither Gallo nor Dr. Fauci has ever demonstrated, using any of the conventional scientific proofs, that the HIV virus alone actually causes AIDS. Rather than allowing his HIV hypothesis to triumph in the marketplace of ideas, Dr. Fauci sent clear signals to the American press that debate on this theory could no longer be tolerated. In September 1989, Dr. Fauci broadcast an angry threat about journalists who dared to give a platform to Peter Duesberg. He ended with this warning, "And they should realize that their accuracy is noted by the scientific community. Journalists who have made too many mistakes or who are sloppy are going to find that their access to scientists may diminish." Dr. Fauci leveraged uncertain tests to paint AIDS as a widespread viral plague. Instead of using traditional methods for diagnosing disease based on symptoms, Dr. Fauci encouraged doctors to perform blood tests on both healthy and unhealthy individuals to diagnose AIDS. Since none of the available tests are particularly accurate, Dr. Fauci must have understood that his reliance on blood tests alone was likely to yield highly dubious results capable of dramatically overstating the spread of HIV. In the decade preceding the AIDS crisis, a wave of new technologies, including PCR and super-powerful electron microscopes, had opened windows on teeming new worlds containing millions of species of previously unknown viruses to scientists. Molecular genetics not only revolutionized biological science, but also made that science fabulously profitable. The lure of fame and fortune ignited a chaotic revolution in virology as ambitious young PhDs scrambled to inculpate newly discovered microbes as the cause of old malignancies. Making such connections could be a profitable pursuit for enterprising young biologists and pharmaceutical companies. Under this new rubric, every theoretical breakthrough, every find became potentially the basis for a new generation of drugs. The opportunity to capitalize on the transfer of information transformed researchers into entrepreneurs and their discoveries into inventions. Science became big business. All this new equipment made science expensive, too expensive to perform without financial support from big pharma and big government. Researchers increasingly relied on Tony Fauci and drug makers to furnish and support their laboratories. Long-term funding became the first requirement of any new research. The researcher got his financing, and Dr. Fauci and the pharmaceutical company got proprietary rights on new discoveries. The self-interest of the researcher, the research institution, and the biotech company converged. Finance dictated the direction of research and, too often, warped its conclusions. Armies of scientists fresh from graduate schools joined the gold rush as Dr. Fauci and Big Pharma grub-staked brigades of young PhDs to prospect for novel viruses in the diseased tissues of sick patients. It was often unclear that the new viruses they found in alien tissues were actually causing the diseases, whether the tiny microbes were free riders colonizing decayed tissue, or altogether innocent bystanders. Harvard's Jim Watson, who won the Nobel Prize in 1962 for discovering the molecular structure of DNA, fretted that the gold rush mentality was likely to scare off the sensible and leave the field to a combination of charlatans and fools. In 2001, alarmed by the precipitous decline in scientific discipline, 14 renowned virologists of the old guard published an appeal to the young, high-technology-focused generation of researchers in science. The graybeards warned the young scientists against attributing culpability to a microbe based upon correlation without first understanding how a newly discovered virus actually causes the disease. Modern methods like PCR, with which small genetic sequences are multiplied and detected, are marvelous, but they tell little or nothing about how a virus multiplies, which animals carry it, how it makes people sick. It is like trying to say whether somebody has bad breath by looking at his fingerprint. Moreover, the evidence linking specific viruses to probable diseases was often subjective and not reproducible. The specific tests that researchers used to detect HIV had their own manner of additional deficiencies. The most significant diagnostic tools that doctors use to determine if someone is infected with HIV or not, and therefore whether they have AIDS, are 1. HIV antibody tests, 2. PCR viral load tests, 3. Helper cell counts, T cells, or rather the T cell subgroup CD4. Antibody test. Gallo used an antibody test of his own invention to detect the presence of the HIV virus in several gay men. But what did his test actually prove? Gallo based his test on an antigen-antibody theory, which assumes the immune system fights against foreign viruses by generating targeted antibodies specific to that virus. In order to calibrate a test to recognize that specific antibody, the inventor must isolate the target virus and expose it to human cells in a petri dish, which then generate the specific antibodies responsive to that virus. However, since it is unclear whether Gallo or any other researcher was ever able to isolate HIV, he took from his AIDS patients a sample of antibodies that he found in great abundance in their blood and made a leap of faith that they were HIV antibodies. Geneticists have pointed out that these antibodies may have been associated with tuberculosis or herpes, or any of the many other pathogenic illnesses that multiply in collapsing immune systems. Indeed, Gallo's HIV antibody test also reacts to people with fever, pregnant women, and individuals who have overcome a tuberculosis infection. Therefore, it is unclear if the antibodies detected by his kit are really HIV antibodies. Neither Gallo's test nor any of the later developed antibody tests have ever proven that these proteins they identify as HIV antibodies have anything to do with HIV or any other retrovirus. The antibody test manufacturers recognize this deficiency with a caveat on their inserts. There is no recognized standard for establishing the presence or absence of antibodies to HIV-1 and HIV-2 in human blood. The same also holds true for the quantitative PCR-based HIV diagnostic test. It's not even a test for HIV, protested Kerry Mullis, who invented the DNA amplification technique commonly used to diagnose AIDS infection. Quantitative PCR is an oxymoron. PCR is intended to identify substances qualitatively, but by its very nature is unsuited for estimating numbers, although there is a common misimpression that the viral load tests actually count the number of viruses in the blood. These tests cannot detect free infectious viruses at all. They can only detect proteins that are believed, in some cases wrongly, to be unique to HIV. The tests can detect genetic sequences of the virus, but not the viruses themselves. In 1986, Thomas Zook of the FDA warned that the HIV antibody tests were not actually designed specially to detect HIV. Rather, numerous other germs or contaminants, including TB, pregnancy, or simple flu, also produce false positives. Zook made that admission at a World Health Organization meeting, but conceded that stopping the use of these HIV tests was simply not practical. He explained that, now that the medical community has identified HIV as an infectious, sexually transmitted virus, public pressure for an HIV test was just too strong. Finally, and most importantly, critics point out that Gallo's HIV antibody tests flipped traditional immunology on its head. Throughout all of medical history, a high antibody level indicated that a person had already successfully battled against an infectious pathogen and was now protected from the disease. With all other viral diseases, the presence of antibodies signals a welcomed immunity from the disease. But Gallo and Dr. Fauci's PIs suddenly began informing people that the positive antibody test was a death sentence. How could this be so? Dr. Fauci has never explained this inexplicable paradox. It gets even weirder when one contemplates Dr. Fauci's $15 billion HIV vaccine enterprise. Usually, regulators measure a vaccine's success by its ability to produce robust and durable antibodies. Now, for the first time in history, Dr. Fauci and Bob Gallo were asking the world to believe that antibodies were a sign of active, deadly disease. This begs the question, what is the HIV vaccine supposed to do? Mulling this conundrum, Reinhard Kurt, former director of the Robert Koch Institute, shrugged his shoulders in bewilderment during a 2004 interview with Der Spiegel. To tell the truth, we really don't know exactly what has to happen in a vaccine so that it protects from AIDS. Perhaps that is the dilemma that has frustrated Dr. Fauci's AIDS vaccine project for 36 years. PCR testing deficiencies. The polymerase chain reaction technique, PCR, does not measure the actual live virus in the body, but the amplified fragments of DNA that are thought to be similar to HIV. But even if those fragments are amplified from the authentic HIV DNA, they could be from an old exposure, from a long-dead virus genetically similar to HIV, left over from an infection that has been suppressed by antibodies, perhaps decades earlier. The HIV test has never been validated, said Carrie Mullis. It doesn't show infection. It shows viral particles that may exist in millions of people. In the late 1980s, the biting and sardonic Mullis became Gallo and Fauci's most fierce critic, in fact, ridiculer. Mullis added, with the PCR method, mind you, not a complete virus, but only very fine traces of genes, DNA, RNA, may be detected. But whether they come from a certain virus or from some other contamination remains unclear. Heinz Ludwig Sanger, professor of molecular biology and 1978 winner of the renowned Robert Koch Prize, stated that HIV has never been isolated, for which reason its nucleic acids cannot be used in PCR virus load test as the standard for giving evidence of HIV. Misdiagnosis of HIV infections by HIV-1 Viral Load Testing, a Case Series, a 1999 paper published in the Annals of Internal Medicine.